Hello there, welcome to this podcast of the IASB and FASB board meeting for the week commencing the 15th of October 2012. My name is Chris Welsh, I'm the communications manager for the IFRS Foundation. I'm joined here today by Stephen Cooper, who is a member of the IASB, and by Sue Lloyd, who is a senior technical director at the IASB. They're kindly going to take us through the proceedings of the board meeting this week. I think we're going to start off with progress made on the insurance project. Stephen, I think you're going to take us through that.
Yes, I certainly am. Thanks, Chris. So we had quite a number of sessions on insurance, both joint sessions with the FASB and also ISB-only sessions. There are four areas that I'd like to focus on within this podcast. The first one is discount rate. And in particular, whilst the board's settled on how we deal with time value of money in the building block approach, there were some outstanding issues in the premium allocation approach. So we have finalised those. We made decisions about how one would deal with the time value of money during the part of the liability for remaining coverage. We decided that we would use a discount rate at inception for that, a locked-in discount rate that's consistent with the building block approach. We also discussed how we would deal with the time value of money in terms of the liability for incurred claims, and the issue there was when we should lock the discount rate. Should it be locked at the inception of the contract or on the date of the incurred claims? There was initially some disagreement between the two boards. The FASB preferred the inception, the ISB initially preferred the rate on the date the claim was incurred, but in the interest of convergence, the ISB changed that decision, so we ended up with agreeing on the rate at the date of issuance of the contract at inception. So we agreed on how to deal with time value of money in the premium allocation approach. Second session was on participating contracts. This was more of an education session. The ISB didn't make any decisions as part of that, and this was all to try and look at how the various decisions that we've taken so far actually would operate for participating contracts. This is the mirroring decision, the OCI decision, and we went through some examples of that, but as I say, we took no decisions, and we are going to revisit this at a later meeting. There are one or two further issues that need to be clarified there. Perhaps the most significant of the areas, though, that we covered this time is the presentation of the building block approach in the Statement of Comprehensive Income. This is an issue that goes back many, many months. The board, having discussed it on numerous previous occasions, the difficulty is how to convert what is essentially a liability measurement model into flows within the Statement of Comprehensive Income. Traditionally, the insurance industry has not recognized revenue in the same way that other industries do. The top line of the income statement is generally more of a premiums due amount. In the ED, we proposed not having that, but instead going for a summarized margin presentation, essentially treating all insurance receipts and payments as deposits and returns of deposits, and just really recognizing the profit. However, over the last few months, the boards have been looking into an approach that would align insurance with revenue recognition. So we would have more of an earned premium approach that was consistent with revenue recognition in the income statement. There are many advantages of this, not least aligning the presentation with the premium allocation approach, getting something that hopefully would be more meaningful to people that don't have the specialist insurance knowledge, and something that's more comparable with other industries. Anyway, we had lengthy discussions. We went through many examples. This is the culmination of many months' hard work on the part of staff who have done an enormous amount of outreach and work on this. But in the end, the boards agreed that we would go with this so-called earned premium approach and have a greater alignment of insurance with revenue recognition. Now, there were a couple of follow-on issues from that, how to deal in the Statement of Comprehensive Income with non-claims fulfillment costs. Essentially, we decided that we would deal with them on a consistent basis, following this earned premium presentation, and also how we would deal with acquisition costs. These would be recognized over the period of coverage, and released on the basis of, well, in the case of the IASB, the same basis that we deal with the residual margins on the basis of the coverage that is provided. So those decisions sort of followed on from what we had, the main decision, which was how to record premiums and claims in the Statement of Comprehensive Income. But the full details of that are obviously reported in update. And then the last issue, the last session that we had was an IASB-only session. And this was doing some clarifications in terms of financial instruments with discretionary participation features. This was all to do with the contract boundary and defining the contract boundary, and also we had some issues to clarify in terms of reclassification. So it's quite likely that the effective date for insurance is going to be after the effective date of the completion of IFRS 9, and we then have to decide, well, when insurance becomes effective, what then happens. So certain redesignation might be possible. So we made some decisions about under what circumstances that redesignation would take place. And this essentially revolves around the fair value option. We also talked about effective date, comparative financial statements. We don't decide on the effective date as part of an exposure draft, but we did say that we certainly recognise that a significant amount of time needs to be allowed between completion of the standard and the effective date, because clearly there's significant systems implications of what we're proposing. So we decided to allow approximately 3 years from the date of publication to the mandatory effective date. We did decide to permit early application. So that's the sort of tentative proposals that we have in terms of transition. And again, more detail about those decisions are available in update. So I think that's about it for insurance.
Okay, thank you very much, Stephen. Moving on to financial instruments, Sue, I wonder if you could take us through discussions surrounding the impairment project.
Sure. So on impairment, at this meeting, the staff basically gave the board feedback from the outreach that we've been undertaking over the last couple of months on the so-called three-bucket expected loss model that we had been developing jointly with the FASB. We brought back the main messages for the board with the objective of trying to get clarity on the way forward. The main messages that we brought back were firstly that most respondents that we spoke to, including the majority of the users of financial statements, agreed with the IASB that it was appropriate to make a distinction between essentially good assets and bad assets when deciding how much of an impairment allowance you should have, with only bad assets being treated with a lifetime expected loss allowance. However, while most people agreed that we should make that distinction, they thought that we needed to make a better distinction between good and bad assets. Basically, they said the guidance that we've developed so far is too unclear and too difficult to operationalise, and so they would like us to make a distinction, but to make a more clear distinction. Also, the feedback was conditional in the sense that we were told that if there was really hardly any difference between the outcome of applying the three-bucket model and an approach more like the FASB, where a lifetime expected loss is recognised on all assets, then the extra effort needed to distinguish between good or bad loans wouldn't be justified, and they'd prefer just to go with a simpler model. So they only want a good and bad distinction if it really makes a difference. The other feedback that we got from a few people that we spoke to was, now that it looks unlikely that we'll have a converged solution, some people are questioning the conceptual merits of the three-bucket model. And they're asking whether, in fact, we should go back to the time proportionate approach for good loans that we had previously exposed in the supplementary document, or whether we should even go so far as all the way back to our original ED, which was more conceptually pure. But those people were in the minority. Based on all of that feedback, the board said that at the moment they wanted to continue developing the three-bucket approach. However, they were responsive to the concerns people have raised about clarity, and so they've asked the staff to bring back some suggestions on how we could clarify the distinction between loans that should have, or assets, sorry, that should have a lifetime allowance balance established for them and those that should have a less than lifetime allowance established. And also, given that some had raised the question of the time proportionate approach, the board asked us to bring back a reminder of how that approach worked and also what the advantages and disadvantages might be of the three bucket approach relative to the time proportionate approach to remind the board. So in the November meeting, we expect the staff to bring back those clarifications and the reminder on the TPA, and we also anticipate that the FASB will provide our board with a public education session in the November meeting to update us on where they've got to with their development of the their impairment model. So that was impairment.
Okay, thanks. There was also a discussion on accounting for macro hedging. Perhaps you'd be kind enough to take us through the updates from that?
Sure. Again, this wasn't a decision-making session on macro hedging. It was further discussion of the revaluation model that the staff has been developing for interest rate portfolio hedging activity. We were discussing another one of the 11 steps. The main discussion this time was around so-called pipeline trades. There were lots of jokes about floating legs and pipeline trades at this meeting. We're in the middle of all the jargon. But essentially what a pipeline trade is a transaction where, for example, a bank might advertise a mortgage deal at a particular interest rate. And by advertising that transaction, they in effect expose themselves to some sort of interest rate risk, even though the transactions aren't locked in. They have a sort of expectation that some will take up the transaction, and that gives rise to anticipated interest rate exposure. Now, when banks manage their interest rate risk, they take into account this exposure from potential pipeline trades as part of their risk management. And so what the board was discussing was, even though there aren't existing assets or liabilities as a result of advertising a particular deal, given that people manage it as part of their interest rate risk management, should the portfolio hedging activity model take it into account to better align with risk management practice? And I think it's fair to say there was a mix of views amongst board members. Some were sympathetic to it and thought that we needed to take pipeline trades into account to properly reflect the risk management perspective. Others were concerned about the disconnect between pipeline trades and current conceptual framework definitions of assets and liabilities, but also noted that we have a conceptual framework project that's about to revisit what assets and liabilities actually are. So I think the general sense was that it was a fair question whether or not pipeline trades should be considered within the model, and that maybe it was an appropriate item to discuss in the upcoming discussion paper to get feedback from our constituents on how we should deal with pipeline trades within the context of the model. But as I said, no decisions were made. It was just further discussing how this model might be developed for the discussion paper.
Okay, thank you very much. Moving on to, I think, revenue recognition. Stephen, maybe you'd like to take us through the developments in this project.
Yeah, certainly will. The revenue recognition, we discussed two main areas. Firstly, contract modifications, and then measuring progress towards complete satisfaction of a performance obligation. I'm not going to say much about contract modifications. Suffice to say that we were largely dealing with clarifications of what was in the exposure draft, improvements to wording. I'm not sure there was an enormous amount in there that was sort of changed the substance of what we had previously decided. And I guess that's similar in terms of progress towards satisfaction of a performance obligation that's satisfied over time. The idea here is that we have to identify when something is satisfied over time, we have to identify the progress towards the entity's satisfaction of that performance obligation. How much work has it actually done? And we'd had a number of questions as a result of the ED about whether units produced and units delivered might be appropriate methods to use. Many said that these were more operational and the way they sort of think about it. Well, units produced and units delivered aren't, strictly speaking, compliant with the objective of measuring performance over time. However, in many situations, they may well be a very close approximation of that correct measure. So what we looked at was circumstances where they would be a reasonable proxy, and this sort of guidance will certainly be reflected in the final standard. So that was more clarification. We also talked about the use of the so-called input method in measuring progress towards satisfaction of a performance obligation. and we discussed some examples there of sort of wastage and the like that can complicate these various measures. So again, went through and agreed on various sort of minor modifications just to clarify exactly what we meant in the exposure draft, but no fundamental change to the principles that we had in the ED.
Okay, thank you very much. And last but not least, IAS 8. Sue, perhaps you could take us through.
Okay, and this is really an update on what we've decided not to do as opposed to what we've decided to do. So in May, the board had tentatively decided to remove a requirement that exists today in IAS 8, which sets out specific disclosure requirements where an entity changes its accounting policy as a result of a change in an IFRS. And the board had tentatively decided in May, as I said, to remove that requirement from IAS 8. But during the balloting process, extra arguments were brought to the staff's attention, including convergence aspects and those sorts of things that hadn't been discussed by the board. And also since May, the staff have actually made some specific changes in the context of projects such as IFRS 9, to remove the specific disclosure requirements on a case-by-case basis. Given that, the ISB decided to stop the limited scope project to amend IAS 8 to stop the balloting process, and rather to look at the issue of comparability more comprehensively in the context of the conceptual framework project that we've just started, and to decide what to do about IAS 8 in the context of that, rather than doing a specific change now. So that means in the interim that on a project-by-project basis, the staff will need to consider and bring to the board issues where we think there's a need for relief from the existing requirements in IAS 8. So no exposure draft now on IAS 8, rather a longer-term review of comparability.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. That brings business for the actual meeting to close. Particularly busy week in the world of standard setting this week here in London. Today is Monday, and tomorrow we have the meeting of the IFRS Foundation's Advisory Council. Later on in the week, we've got a large gathering. The World Standard Setters meeting is taking place as an annual event held also here in London. And I believe towards the end of this week is also the Capital Markets Advisory Committee meeting. So all hands on deck.
That's right. And actually in Zurich today, simultaneously with the Advisory Council, we've got the International Forum of Accounting Standard Setters meeting as well. So a busy week for standard setting.
Sure. Okay. Well, thank you very much. Our next podcast will be after the November board meeting, which begins the week commencing the 19th of November. And just a quick disclaimer at the end of this broadcast. These are obviously the personal views of the presenters and may not necessarily represent those of the IASB. The official summary of the board meeting is provided by IASB Update, which is available to download from our website. Stephen, thank you very much.